Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Before we introduce this week's guest, I want to give a shout out to our Patreon supporters. Patreon is a great way to support everything Cool Tools does, including our newsletters, podcast, video channel, and our review website. This week, we want to give a shout out to Cindy Sherman and Nick Gray. Thanks to both of you. To become a patron of Cool Tools, visit patreon.com/cooltools. Our guest this week is Sam Maggs. Sam is a best-selling author of books, including The Unstoppable Wasp, Built on Hope, Conquest, and Tell No Tales, as well as comics, including Marvel Action, Captain Marvel, My Little Pony, and Transformers, and video games as well, like Marvel's Spider-Man and Ratchet and Clank. She's also an on-air host for networks like Nerdist. Hey, Sam, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks so much for having me today. I'm excited to talk about some cool tools.
Yes, Yay. And we're so excited to hear what they are, and I'm glad to have met you.
Oh, me too. Thanks.
You have some exciting news about something coming up, but we'll save that for after we're done talking about some of your tools. So why don't you start and tell us about this free online game writing tool? That sounds really cool.
Yeah, so my day job is writing for video games, which is super fun. And people always ask me how they can get into it. And I always recommend using this tool. It's called Twine. You can find it at twinery.org. And the great thing about Twine is that it's basically you can do it completely in browser. You don't even have to download anything. And it allows you to make your own text-based, essentially choose your own adventure style video games,
or like your
old DOS games. Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, wow. Like the old Infocom games.
Exactly like that, you know, where you can kind of click. I mean, cool. There's a little more interactivity where you get to click, you know, I go left, I go right or whatever, but you can write your own game start to finish with lots of choice options for players. And it's incredibly easy to learn. There's a whole tutorial system and wiki right on the tool. So it's very simple for folks, even if you have little to no knowledge of like HTML or coding or tagging or anything, you can pick it up super fast. And then you can publish it for free on a site that they have that hosts all of these. So you can have other people play it as well. And it's great to be able to use as if you want to kind of add to your portfolio, or if you want to show people your writing, or if you want to be able to say, I built my own game. This is a perfect way to do it completely for free on your own.
So this is a text-based game. You're writing mostly text. And when you play the game, when a player plays the game, they are seeing kind of an old school game, which is, you know, you are in the dark, deep cave and there's a door on the left. And is that the kind of a game that you'll play?
That's exactly right. And then instead of entering, like typing go left, this, you use your mouse. So you give the player the option to click, like I go right, or right. I just like to talk to the person. Right,
but there's no pictures or graphics.
If you get a little more advanced in Twine, you can add stuff like that eventually, but there's absolutely no necessity for it. And you can do, if that's not your jam, you can go entirely text-based, which is how I use it, because I can't do that stuff.
That's nice.
So do you, even though you are a professional, do you still use Twine to write stories?
You can use Twine, especially if you're kind of playing around with branching dialogue. So if you want to figure out, like, what do I want my options to be for players? But the place where folks use it most in the professional gaming industry is actually as an audition tool. So my first
as you say, as an audition tool?
Yeah, like as a portfolio piece, essentially. So if you're interviewing for a game job and they might ask you to build a narrative in Twine so that they can see your mastery over dialogue choices, or that you understand what branching dialogue is. You know, you can use it to apply for jobs, basically.
I see.
Yeah.
And so if there was kind of one little hint that you were going to give people about making forking dialogue, what would that be? What should somebody, a beginner, kind of know about writing Forking Dialing before they start?
That's a great question. I think the truest answer to that is to always remember that players want choices that have meaningful consequences. So if you give a player two options and they both lead to the same place without really any difference between the two things you've made them pick, they're going to be disappointed. But if there's meaningful choice, and that can mean anything from, you know, something as basic as you die if you go one way versus the other, to you get a different colored hat, or you get a cool, like, you know, personal item, or you get a cool personal moment with a character, that can be meaningful choice. You know, that makes a difference. So,
And how important is it to kind of give a hint about those different payoffs, that in one case you die, in the other case you get a pretty little sticker?
It's super important. You always want to try to telegraph to the player what they're going to get if they make that choice. You try not to trick the player into making a choice they don't want, because then they feel betrayed.
Okay.
Interesting. That's cool. And so does it allow you to do text input as well as point and click?
You know, I'm actually not entirely certain about that. Mm-hmm. I think there are fields for that. Okay. I've only ever used point and click, but I'm sure you can do almost anything with it. It's very versatile. So, yeah.
And you said this is like an open source for free. Does Twine have a business model?
It was started by an individual named Chris Klemas back in 2009, and now it's maintained by several different repositories. So it's people mm-hmm. who maintain it, kind of, you know, like a collective wiki.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
it looks like it's part of the Interactive Fiction Technology Foundation.
Oh, so interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's keepers, there's people who are committed to keeping it going.
Indeed.
As a public service. Well, that's really so not only is it a tool that will allow you to write your own, but it runs like a library of ones previously written that you can explore and learn from.
Definitely. Yeah.
Is there anywhere where someone has sort of curated some of the more better or interesting ones? If you're just like a newbie and you land there?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I just, even a quick Google search of the top games made with Twine will take you to a site called Itch.io. Okay. Which is the repository for these games, and you'll kind of see, it'll show you all of the most downloaded or most played or best rated games, including Depression Quest, which was very famous for a while, and things as silly as Pomeranian Simulator 9000, where you get to be a Pomeranian, to you know, a Tale of Crowns, which is a high fantasy. It really runs the gamut.
Wow, that's really great. And just to, again, kind of reinforce this, this idea of having kind of divergent and forking paths is sort of a central element of video games anyway, and that this is like a key skill that you would want to have no matter what kind of video game you're making in the future. Would you say that's true?
I would agree with that, because even games that don't necessarily have traditional branching dialogue where you're making dialogue choices, you know, all games depend on player choice and player agency. And so this gives you a good way to practice prioritizing player agency.
Okay. That's really great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Super cool.
Yeah.
So Sam, tell us about your next one. A couple of people we've interviewed before have told us about bullet journals, but this sounds like a new a notebook that I haven't heard about. Tell us about it and kind of explain what a bullet journal is again, because I'm still not completely clear on what it is.
Yeah, I completely understand. So my next cool tool is the Archer and Olive dot grid notebook, or bullet journal, essentially. So before I talk about Archer and Olive, what a bullet journal is basically a blank notebook that, instead of lines, has a bunch of dots in a grid on every page. And what you do with a bullet journal is you basically just make your own planner. So instead of a pre-made planner that you buy that has a certain amount of space already blocked off for each day in a calendar month, you know, it gives you like three or four lines for every day during a week. It's freeform. So you can organize that calendar however you want by drawing it yourself. So in my bullet journal, you know, I have at the front, I have a little space for every upcoming month where I put, you know, if I have something coming up in November, I can put it in the November section. And then when November comes around, I make a little month calendar where I can then transfer everything from there into the this like calendar page. And then every week I make a weekly spread where I take a couple pages of my bullet journal and I put down all of my days that week, all the things that are going on. So I, you know, I constantly have a view of what's going on and what's coming up for me. And then every day I kind of write down, okay, today is Monday, November 1st. And I take the things that I've, the tasks that I have in that weekly spread and put them on this list, as well as anything that comes up during that day. So, you know, all my meetings, all my writing tasks, any appointments that I have, all of that goes on the page. And what's great about it being free form is that if you have a Monday that has 67 things that you need to do and a Tuesday that has nothing, you're not frantically trying to cram in all 67 things into that same amount of space. It's you
Which
have
is a problem
the freedom.
With regular schedules, it is.
And it's great to have that freedom to also just, if you want to make a bunch of notes about some random thing during a meeting, you can take a page to do that. Like it's very open.
And is the analog aspect of this important? Because from all that you were describing, I could kind of imagine doing it on a computer kind of faster, more efficiently, I think. But you are choosing to do it in a physical paper book. Is that important?
Yes. So what I had been finding is that trying to do everything digitally, I was forgetting things all the time. It wasn't like being downloaded into my brain, really, because it is faster and more ephemeral. For me, anyway, doing it digitally, when I have to put it, write it down on this piece of paper, A, you're writing it down multiple times because you have it written down for your month and then you write it down again in the week and then you write it down again on the day. So you're like extra making sure that you're not forgetting these things. As well as it being a little bit easier to just kind of like jot things down, cross them off. It gives you that very like tactile sensation of if you like to make lists and check things off lists, it's very physically satisfying, which can be a motivator to get things done in a really small way. So I find that it helps me. When I was using the computer, I was forgetting stuff all the time. And when I use a bullet journal, I'm much more, I never miss a meeting.
Just the act of writing it down kind of.
Indeed, kind
stick.
Of. And this, I've always sort of been that way. I think even when I was studying in, for my master's or in college, I would write out my notes by hand when I was going to study. I think it just like implants in my brain better if I use my hand to make it. So
yeah,
that's what I like about that. The bullet journal concept. And what's cool about, there are lots of bullet journal companies, but what I really like about Archer and Olive is that it's run by a woman who has bipolar disorder and generalized anxiety disorder. And so she was really, it was a struggle for her to navigate her tasks and her mental health at the same time. And so she's developed this sort of journal because it was something that really helped her. I also have anxiety. And so I think it's cool that this woman, Bonnie Cool, you know, made this from a place of wanting to help other people who are struggling with their mental health and trying to stay on top of their tasks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have a special like set of colored pens you use with it?
I do. So I have no artistic talent whatsoever, like zero. And I think a lot of people, when they're thinking about getting into bullet journals, go online and see all these like incredibly artistic people who make amazing spread. My bullet journal looks like garbage. And you know what? It doesn't matter because nobody else is ever going to see it. Only I'm going to see it. It only has to function for me. So I get a lot of fun colored pens. I buy washi tape. So like fun patterned tapes. And lot like cool stickers. I go to a lot of comic cons, stuff like that. I love to grab stickers from independent artists. And so my bullet journal is just full of fun, cool stickers and absolutely no hand-drawn art whatsoever. And it constantly looks like a mess.
There are a lot of great artists who can't draw. Let me tell you that.
So. There you
so
go.
True.
Drawing is not required to be an artist. Although it is interesting that you mentioned that you don't have artistic talent, yet you are working for and with comic book graphic novelists. Mm-hmm. Do you find that that's a handicap or an advantage for writing content for graphic novel?
Well, I think there are a lot of really amazing writer slash artists in comics who make wonderful graphic novels. I do not have that skill or have not developed it. But the benefit of that for me is that I now get to collaborate with a bunch of incredible artists on all of these projects. And what I love about that is that I can imagine things in my mind when I'm writing a comic and setting up panels on the page and figuring out what I want to go in each panel. But the artists that I work with are all so incredibly talented themselves that they take what I've put down and then put their own spin on it and elevate it to that next level in a way that I could never do myself, even if I was drawing the thing, because, you know, two minds are better than one often on this stuff, right? So it's the benefit for me is that I get to collaborate with very talented people who make my work better.
Going back to you putting things into panels, when you do that, preparing it to give to the artist, are you just still putting text into a panel, or do you make even kind of the most crudest general little doodle?
Some comic book artists do little doodles, especially if it's a more complicated panel that they feel that they can't explain adequately, and so they're like, oh, like this. But most of the time, you're basically writing a text script that says, panel one, in this panel, Captain Marvel jumps, and then you write the dialogue beneath that. So it's okay. Kind of set up that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I was involved with in a graphic novel that was way too big and way too long with a lot of people, many of them very really talented, and so it is something I might want to try again.
Yeah,
maybe with less people this time. And I was just curious about how you worked. For your work, when you are writing for a comic book or a game, you're still, again, you're just like in a word processor, like in a Word or a Google Doc. That's all you really need. Is that right?
For comics and novels, yes. I just use Microsoft Word. Some people like Scrivener.
Yeah.
I have never used Scrivener. It is potentially better, but I've just never bothered to try it. But yeah, for comics and for novels, I use Microsoft Word. For video games, traditionally, most writers use Excel. Microsoft
what?
Excel. Yes, because...
Wait. The writing in Excel?
Most game writing takes place in Excel because most game writing is the stuff you never think about, like 10,000 combat barks of like enemies saying, get down. Hey, you over there. I'm hurt. Help me. In 47 different ways to say each one of those things. And they're exported from the game engine in an Excel spreadsheet that many of the cells are filled with things that the game needs to know where, how, and when to play that line of dialogue. So you'll get this huge Excel spreadsheet with fields that are like, who's saying it? In what circumstance do they say it? A bunch of different versions of them saying it in different ways. The code that the developer then has to input into the engine so that it knows how to read that line, and then just one field of all of those is where the line goes. So I spend most of my time, I would say, working for video games in Excel, which is bananas.
Wow.
And then a lot.
Wow, that is the most amazing thing I've heard all day.
Isn't it strange? It's Google Sheets. Like most of us use Google Sheets so that all the different devs can kind of edit it simultaneously, basically. But games that use branching dialogue often have a proprietary software in engine that does help facilitate that, kind of like Twine. And then if you're writing performance capture scenes or the more cinematic scenes, we use the same software that movie or television screenwriters use, which is called Final Draft.
Final Draft, right.
Those
right.
scenes are shot like a film.
Right.
So we work in several different...
right, the Final Draft would be more cinematic kind of.
That's exactly right.
Setting the screen, interior, yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
But most of the dialogue you hear when you're actually playing a video game, like not watching a cutscene, but with your hands on the sticks, and dialogue that's firing while you're running around an open world, while you're in combat, that's all in an Excel spreadsheet somewhere. It's not very glamorous. I'll tell you that.
Wow. Okay. You've made my day.
I can send you an example.
As soon as you said it, I could imagine it.
Yeah.
And all those cells are linked, right? It's like almost like a relational database. You could be.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And then they'll also have information in those fields that are about like, has this line been recorded yet? Does it need to be re-recorded?
Oh, so it's also a production tool.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Wow. That's fantastic. So, tell us about another tool on your list.
This one is cool. The Yoshitani's Tarot of the Divine.
Yes. So I am a big fan of tarot readings as a tool that you can use in your daily life to kind of guide you in the right direction. If you're looking for some answers or some guidance, or you need to figure out a problem, or you're not sure how to take a new approach to something, I like to use tarot cards to help with that. Or even in my writing, if I'm kind of like, what should this character be like? It can be fun to draw a card as like an inspiration moment. So most people use a traditional deck, but Yoshi Yoshitani, who is a wonderful comic book artist, she just worked on Zatanna for DC, stuff like that. She's come out with her own tarot deck, fully illustrated by herself, and a book to go along with it. And the cool thing about this tarot, it's called the Tarot of the Divine. And what she's done is each card is modeled after a story from a selection of fables and folktales from cultures all over the world. So the Fool is based on the Little Mermaid, which was from a Danish tale. The Lovers is based on China's Beauty and the Beast story. The World card is based on the Maori legend of Hinamoa and Tutanekai, which I almost certainly pronounced incorrectly. And the Suits, which are typically cups, coins, swords, and wands, draw from cultural fables and ancient mythologies like Japan's The Crane Wife, Persia's Aladdin, you know, England's Jack and the Beanstalk. So you get this amazing tarot deck with this 44-page guidebook that tells you not only how to interpret the cards, but also gives you a little background on each of the fables on each of the cards. So it's pretty cool.
Wow. I understand that kind of the potency of having these kind of random prompts in the card, in the way the cards do that. Some people have used the I Ching, and there's another alternative which you may want to be aware of and give it a try, which is called the Oblique Strategy Deck by Brian Eno. And it's a set of cards that he and his partner Peter Schmidt back in the day developed for their studio, in the studio when they were writing music and recording and producing, and it was a way for them to get unstuck.
Oh, cool.
And their kind of assignments, or maybe I would call it, prompts is a better word, to just kind of get you to think differently and laterally. And it's a nice little box set of cards that may perform some of the same function as your as this deck.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. I love anything like that, that can kind of help you to approach a problem in a new way, or even, you know, give you a new perspective on something or force you to think about something differently. It can be difficult as a writer. Sometimes everybody gets stuck, everybody gets blocks, or, you know,
right,
trapped in the same patterns, stuff like that. So they're a great tool for that. And I love the combination in this deck of, you know, not only the beautiful illustrations, because they are beautiful, but it was super cool being able to learn about all these folktales from different cultures that I had never heard of before. And it made me want to go investigate each tale for each card that I pulled more thoroughly.
Right. So I was just checking to see, it's about, I don't know, maybe $25 or something. But how many cards are in the deck just for the informational aspect?
Yeah, you get 44 cards.
44, okay.
I believe. I think that's
cool.
Yeah.
That sounds really good. Just to give people an idea of the Oblique Strategies one, I'm just looking at a couple of the cards here.
I'm sorry, 78.
78, okay.
One is use an old
Oblique Strategy, right?
Yeah, Oblique Strategy. Use an old idea. state the problem in words as clearly as possible, and only one element of each kind.
That's cool.
Right. There are others I remember, like expand the middle, pretend you're a robot. What would they do in Africa? I mean, they're just very kind of.
I love that.
What would your closest friend do?
Yeah. Ask your mother.
That's so great. Yeah. Sorry, I misspoke. It's 78 cards and a 44-page guidebook. That's
okay. Cool. That's great. Yeah. So beneath the moon, that looks amazing. I think I want to get this for my kids and family.
Because, yeah. Great. A holiday gift, I think.
Yeah.
Super
that
cool.
That was fantastic. What a great pick.
Thanks.
Thanks so much. And so tell us about this hand sanitizer that you like.
So yes, my last pick is a hand sanitizer because I feel like it's something that we're all using a lot of right now. And if we're not, we probably should be, though it's no substitute for washing your hands, but still it can be good when you're out and about on the run. In a pinch. Yep. And what I love about this hand sanitizer by Squalwin is that it was developed by a woman called Lee Joseph, and she is part of the Squamish Nation, an Indigenous First Nations person in Canada. And so she actually has a degree, a master's degree in science from the University of Victoria, and she is using her master's degree for her company, Squalwin Botanicals, to kind of look at natural elements and reconnecting to her ancestral Squamish lands and traditions and combining those two things together to make a line of skincare, essentially, which includes this awesome hand sanitizer called MEMS. And what's great about MEMS is that it is, of course, made with 99% isopropyl alcohol, which is a hand sanitizer, but then she combines it with Usnea lichen, which is antibacterial and antimicrobial, and also Labrador tea, which is Canadian witch hazel, and lavender, eucalyptus, and sage essential oil. So she's basically combining the traditions of the Squamish Nation with real science to make a great hand sanitizer. And we're all buying sanitizer anyway. I feel as though it is a much better choice to support an Indigenous woman's small business than to just give our money to more big corporations. You know, if we're going to buy it anyway, might as well make a smart purchasing decision if we have to exist within capitalism.
Right.
Which sadly, we do.
Yeah. And so it's really not that expensive. It's like $10 Canadian or like $7.50 US.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Wow.
Super cheap.
Yeah. And I love that it smells nice because a lot of hand sanitizer smells terrible.
Yeah, they do.
Don't they? And we're all using so much of it lately.
So awful.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really neat to think about ways that we can create ethical and sustainable businesses that are grounded in your culture, whatever that might be, as a way to kind of connect to your past, but also to bring to the masses this thing that is important to you and your family and respectful of your culture. You know, the Squamish elders have been using plants as medicine historically for many centuries. So it's neat to combine that with modern medicine and in this very useful way for all of us right now.
Very nice. Mimpts, kind of like mints, but an M in
exactly. Yeah.
Okay, good. So, Sam, I want to make sure we have some time to talk about your new book, which sounds fantastic. The Fangirl's Guide to the Universe and the Fangirl's Journal for Leveling Up. And they're coming out at the end of October. So, probably right around the time this comes out, they'll be available. Tell us about these.
Oh, yeah. Well, back in 2015, my first book ever published was called The Fangirl's Guide to the Galaxy, a handbook for girl geeks. And it was basically a handbook for getting girls into geek culture. So if you wanted to get into comics or video games, sci-fi, it was kind of a how-to guide. And if you already liked those things, it was a great way to tell you how to go to your first convention, how to meet like-minded people online or in person, how to incorporate feminism into your fandom. And with the Fangirls Guide to the Universe coming out on October 27th, I've actually been able to put together a second edition of Fangirls Guide. So it's fully updated for 2020. It has all new art by Kat Goodlow. She's wonderful. And we've got all new references in there, all new interviews with awesome female creators in the nerd industry. And the same day, it's coming out with its own companion guided journal called the Fangirls Journal for Leveling Up. So you can, kind of like my bullet journal, I love journaling. You can use this journal to write down your own experiences with fandom. It's fully guided, also fully illustrated by Kat Goodlow. It matches the guide, and you can kind of personalize it and use it to make notes and think hard about your own journey into fandom and feminism and what that means for you.
The kind of person that you wrote the book for is somebody who is kind of maybe interested in this stuff but feels a little bit intimidated or lost, and you're kind of giving them a little bit of hand-holding as they enter into this and guiding them through kind of maybe steps to take, a sequence of things to do, what to do first. Is that the general idea?
Yeah, definitely. That's one type of person who can get into it. It's great for parents who are kind of looking to connect with their nerdy kid. It makes a great gift, I think, for that kind of thing. I've heard that a lot. It's also great if you're into geek culture and you're trying to think about like how to take it to the next level. You know, maybe how do I start my own fandom-based business, or I feel like I've read and watched everything that I already know about. What else should I get into? Or I'm really into video games, so I've never checked out anime before. Like, how do I get into that? If you're looking to branch out, it's good for that as well as beginners or tentative newbies or the curious.
That sounds so cool. And I have a 17-year-old daughter, I think, who would love this because she is a video game designer, and she writes games using C# and Unity, and we watch anime together every night, and we have been playing the Danganronpa video game series together. So
I mean, every fangirl needs a Mark as her father. It's
very- Yes, I was very lucky to have extremely nerdy parents growing up, which is how I guess I didn't rebel to get into football or whatever. I just kind of like went with it.
That's so cool.
And that's why I, you know, do what I do today. But I did feel like growing up, I was really alone. Like I didn't know a lot of other gals my age who were into the same stuff that I was into, and it was hard to find them. And I was afraid of being really open about liking this stuff because I thought I'd get made fun of. And, you know, I really wanted to write Fangirls Guide for, you know, 15-year-old me who wished that I could have felt seen or to know that there were other people like me, you know.
And so are you running like a Discord in parallel to actually make a community around this?
I think that's a great idea. I am terrible at that. I'm too old to do that. I feel that there is someone to come after me who reads Fangirl's Guide to do that. This more tells you how to find existing communities. I'm terrible with Discord. People keep trying to get me to join their channels, and I'm always like, yeah. And then I never use it. My phone causes me a lot of anxiety. I constantly have it set to do not disturb. So the thought of like another thing to check socially is like, it's not for me, but I think it's great for other people. Yeah.
My daughter set us up with a family Discord server.
That's great.
So we're keeping busy on that. It's fun. I'm glad she did it. And the funny thing is, and I think all teenagers know this, is that Discord is like a far superior platform over Zoom. It has video chat. It has phone. It has amazing like file sharing capabilities. And it's better than Slack too. It's crazy, but it's only like kids know when use Discord for the most part. And it's like the adults are using like the clunky bad stuff, which I guess is kind of to be expected, right?
Yeah. They take the cool thing and corporatize it and make it uncool. Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. You must know Bonnie Burton.
Yes, indeed. We went on book tour together a few years ago, which is wonderful.
That's so funny. I just hearing you talk, it reminds me so much. Bonnie and I met each other in 1990.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in Boulder, Colorado, when she was a DJ for Channel 12, and she was like the kind of the local MTV DJ there. And I was just starting my zine Boing Boing with my wife, Carla. And we used to hang out in coffee stores in Boulder. And then both migrated to California.
Bonnie is like an idol of mine. Like, I would not be doing what I'm doing without people like Bonnie who did it first. So
yeah, Bonnie's great.
Iconic. So cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I just knew you would know her.
Totally.
That's cool. Well, so the Fangirl's Guide to the Universe and the Fangirl's Journal for Leveling Up, they are out October 27th, which is probably right around the time this comes out. Please check them out. And Sam, where can people go? Where's the one URL you recommend that people can go to find out about you?
You could just visit my website, sammags.com. That's SammAggs. My Twitter and Instagram are just my name. So more of the same. I am unfortunately always on Twitter.
Okay. That sounds good. And we will definitely have links to all of this stuff, all your contact info and all the things you talked about at cool-tools.org, where you can see all the show notes and everything. Sam, this has been such a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a delight.
Hey, everybody. It's your co-host, Mark. And I wanted to let you know that we have a lot more going on here in Cool Tools than just this podcast. We have our flagship website where we review a new tool every day. That's at cool-tools.org. We also have 4 different newsletters. We have this podcast. We have a YouTube channel where we review tools. And if you like what you hear and see and read, the best way to help us out is by going to our Patreon page at patreon.com/cooltools and donate at any level you wish. You can even contribute $1 a month, and that would mean a lot to us. The money that you give us will go towards paying for our transcribing costs, editing videos, and editing the podcast. It goes towards paying contributors who write the reviews for us. It goes towards our equipment costs, our hosting costs, and it supports our very small company of 3 people. This week, I wanted to give a shout out to some of our Patreon supporters who have been giving us at least $2 a month. And if you give us $2 a month, we'll give you a shout out online. And this week, I would like to thank Michael Sacochia, Molly Starr, M. Velderman, Opposable Thumbs, Pamela Cooley, Patrick Weyer, Paul Hosey, Randy Fisher, Stuart Burroughs Brand, Synaptic Sam, Therese Schwartz, Tom Hawkins, Tom Markham, What Bear, Javier Pangolin, David Lang, Eric Byers, Sean Hartley, Stephen Powell, Greg Lichtscheidt, John Hobson, Adam Bristol, Adam Naher, Anonymous, Bill Kempthorne, Bruce I. Niles, Chris Woodruff, C. Kolos, Daryl Flynn, Egg Fleegoff, Eric Hanschrau, Eric Hoover, Godfrey Saldana, Jay Skiles, John M. Larson, Jude Galligan, Kenneth Gilman, and Lucas Frank. Thank you very much for supporting the show, and we will see you next week.